We should have Susan Chomsky on the line. Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, excellent. So far, so good. It's worked well. Anyway, delighted to have you with us today. Susan Chomsky is the author of the new book, Maharishi and Me, Seeking Enlightenment with the Beatles Guru, published by Skyhorse Publishing this year. And its timing is good because this is the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' trip to Rishikesh in 1968. They spent, among the four of them, various lengths of time there, as well as other musicians who were there at the same time. But also, and Susan Chomsky talks about the Beatles' trip in detail in her book, but also the greater part of the book is about your own spiritual journey, and I certainly want to discuss that with you as well. So why don't we start with, which I found very interesting, and I'd like to come back to a couple of things. You date your spiritual birth to a chance encounter with somebody named Bob in 1966 in San Francisco, yes?
In Oakland, California, that's right. He appeared outside my apartment, and he was very different than the other people that were hanging around there because I lived near the California College of Arts and Crafts, and there was nothing but a bunch of hippies around there. And this gentleman certainly was no hippie. He didn't dress like one. He didn't act like one. He was not flirtatious like one. And for some reason, I just felt he was very compelling. And I asked him if he would like to have lunch and come up to my apartment. And so I invited him, and he came upstairs. And he said, I said, well, all I have is canned spaghetti and meatballs. And he said, no, I don't eat that. I'm a vegetarian. And I thought, a vegetarian, that's weird. The only other vegetarian I'd ever met was our cleaning lady, who was Seventh-day Adventist. So he said, I'll take tea. So we had tea together. And then he started saying all these extremely esoteric things to me. I didn't understand what he was really talking about. And at some point during our conversation, he said, I am a yogi. I didn't know what a yogi was. He said, I'm a yogi. And because I'm a yogi, I have time to spend all day polishing the things in my house. And as he said that, he was making a gesture in the air as though he was polishing a candlestick or something like that. And I thought, well, this is really weird. And also, as I was speaking with him, I thought about maybe trying to seduce him or something because I was a hippie, you know, and I was a flower child and it was all about free love. But there was something about him that was kind of like an anti-sex repellent. I don't know. I just I knew that I couldn't do that.
That wasn't why he was there.
That was not why he was there. So he said that these enigmatic statements, and then he said that he had to leave, and he left as mysteriously as he came and walked out the door, and that's the last time I ever saw him, at least in that particular form. So I thought, well, that's very strange, but it was only a few days after that I found the book Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda, and in that book there was three chapters about a being named Babaji who it was claimed by Yogananda that he was an immortal master who lived in the Himalayas. And so that was really the start of my spiritual journey, was meeting this strange gentleman.
Whom you never saw again, although he introduced himself, interestingly, as Bob, correct?
Yes, and I did see him again, but in other forms.
Which I want to come back to, but soon enough you found a meditation center in San Francisco. You were basically you were a flower child at the time, right? And soon found a meditation center in San Francisco.
I was absolutely a flower child. I was a hippie. I dressed like one, act like one, embraced the whole counterculture lifestyle. So I was raring to go, hippified flower child. And, you know, I sewed my own wild flower children costume and so on. And a friend took me to the Transcendental Meditation Center, which is in Berkeley, California. But there was no teacher there. But I saw the photo on the wall of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. His picture was hanging on the wall. And as soon as I saw his picture, it was like, yes, this is my teacher, and this is where I'm going to learn real meditation, because I had been seeking to learn meditation. In Alan Watts' books, I was reading all these books about higher consciousness and meditation and the psychedelic experience and all of these things I was reading and studying about higher consciousness. But in Alan Watts' books, it said that you have to find a quote-unquote meditation guide. Well, in Berkeley, California in 1966, you didn't exactly go to the yellow pages and find meditation guide or anything remotely similar to that. But there, a friend did take me to the Transcendental Meditation Center. And as I said, there was no teacher there, but I had to wait 9 months in order to learn Transcendental Meditation. Finally, I learned in August of 1967, right smack dab in the summer of love, I learned Transcendental Meditation.
And that's just about the time. We have kind of parallel threads that we'll be discussing today. Just about the same time that really the Beatles are getting indoctrinated, learning the principles of Transcendental Meditation, too. This was also a weekend in August of 1967 that they were doing the same thing in England.
Exactly. And in fact, George Harrison and Patty Boyd, who were married to each other, they came to the Summer of Love. They came to Haight-Ashbury to check it out. They were disillusioned by it because they felt that all they saw was a bunch of dirty people that were not really necessarily spiritually inclined. But they were spiritually inclined, and they ended up at Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's lecture that he was giving at the Hilton Hotel on August 24th of 1967. So they attended the lecture along with the other Beatles and Beatles' wives. The only one who did not attend was Ringo, because his wife was in the hospital. She had just had...
Their child had
just had one of their children. And so Ringo wasn't there, but the other ones were, and they were very favorably impressed by Maharishi. And after the lecture, the Transcendental Meditation leader from England, whose name was Snell, he invited them backstage to meet Maharishi. And so they met him, and they explained to him that they had been seeking spirituality for quite a long time, and that they had tried LSD, they had tried drugs, psychedelic drugs, but it didn't really work out for them, really, to have genuine spiritual experiences. But they were very keen to learn from him. So Maharishi was very pleased about it, and he asked them to join him on a meditation retreat that he would begin the next day. On August 25th, there was a meditation retreat starting in Bangor, North Wales. So the Beatles traveled by train with Maharishi and with Mick Jagger and Marianne Faithfull and some other rock stars, went to this training up in Bangor, North Wales, and that's where they learned TM on August 25th.
And coincidentally, I should say, their manager, Brian Epstein, died just a couple of days later. And so that was a momentous time for the group, certainly.
Absolutely. The thing was that they were going to stay at that retreat for 10 days, but their stay got cut short because on the 27th of August, unfortunately, Epstein died, and so they had to rush back to London. Mm-hmm. They were only there, in other words, on the retreat for 2 days.
And again, is this about the same time that you over here in the United States that you met Maharishi?
It was around the same time that I met Maharishi. He came to Los Angeles in September, right after the Beatles met him. He came to Los Angeles in September of 1967, and I met him at the airport. And then I saw him give a lecture. He came to the airport, met him at the airport, went to his lecture.
And you also write, though, it's interesting, you say when you did meet him the first time, he smiled at everyone else but not me. At the time, I didn't know Maharishi's scowl was just the first of many tests he would deliver. This was the beginning, or perhaps a continuation, of a unique relationship that would change me profoundly. And I think that's at least an understatement, isn't it, based on your book?
Yeah, I'd say that is a kind of an understatement. It was very strange. I was dressed in my normal quote-unquote hippie attire. I was wearing this ugly rayon dress that I'd gotten at a junk store. I had on my granny glasses, my hippie beads, my really clunky hippie shoes, which were these leather, horrible-looking clunky leather shoes with big nails hammering it, you know, keeping them together. And I looked completely ridiculous. My hair was all frizzy. I didn't have a bra. I didn't shave my legs and my underarms. I was a hippie. What can you say? So when he got to me on the line and I handed my wildflowers to him, he stopped, actually, first of all. You know, he didn't do that with other people. He stopped. He looked me up. He looked me down. He looked me up. He looked me down. He scowled. And then he just grabbed my wildflowers from me and gave me a dirty look. And so it was very different than other people were experiencing as he was going up and down the line and corridor of people, let's say. And he was smiling and cooing and laughing and giggling with all these other people. And me, all I got was a scowl.
Although you came to realize that there was really more to it than that. It wasn't simply displeasure, no, put it that way.
No.
And
I don't think it was at all.
You stayed in the U.S. for a couple more years. So actually, although you write in great detail about the Beatles and other recording artists, Mike Love of the Beach Boys and Donovan and so on, about their trip to Rishikesh, to the Maharishi's ashram in early 1968. You were not there at the time, although I'm sure you must know people who were there. And I've got to say, you've done a very good job researching that in this very important part of your book.
Yes, yeah. I did a lot of research to find out what really happened. And I don't think there's any other book that goes into as much detail about what happened to the Beatles in Rishikesh.
Probably not. No, which I do want to talk about, but why don't we pop in a musical selection just to kind of get things going. I brought in some Donovan because Donovan was there at the time, and of course some Beatles stuff, and the Beach Boys, of course, okay, with their song Transcendental Meditation. Mike Love, I guess,
okay,
he was already into this before, if I'm not mistaken. I think he was he learned TM in 67, if not earlier than that.
He learned TM in December of 1967. He met Maharishi at a UNICEF concert on December 15th of 1967. And the other Beach Boys, too. They all learned together.
Well, why don't we listen? Let's listen to Transcendental Meditation, which they put on the Friends album that came out in 1968. So here's the Beach Boys. And again, and Mike Love, who I interviewed on this show some years ago, I guess he is certainly stuck with TM for all these years, and I think he's still a very serious and devoted practitioner.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's a big advocate of TM.
Transcendental meditation can emancipate the man and get you feeling grand. Fusion of the never-changing wind, the ever-changing.
Beach Boys with Transcendental Meditation. which they recorded on their released on their Friends album in 1968. And as we just said, Mike Love, longtime practitioner of Transcendental Meditation. My guest, who just joined us here on the Friday Lost and Found, my guest by telephone is Susan Shumsky, author of the new book, Maharishi and Me, Seeking Enlightenment with the Beatles Guru, published by Skyhorse Publishing. And I assume it's also available in electronic form, is it not?
It's available in electronic form. It's available as an audiobook CD as well, and the hardbound book.
And you've got a very interesting appendix at the back of the book listing many notable people who've gotten into Transcendental Meditation, and it's a very, very interesting list. We don't have time to go through the whole list, but we might mention for Lost and Found fans, the three instrumentalists in The Doors were all kind of early advocates of TM, Robbie Krieger, John Densmore, and Ray Manzarek. They had met each other before they met Jim Morrison.
They met each other at a Transcendental Meditation introductory lecture, strangely enough. So they famously always say that if it hadn't been for Maharishi and Transcendental Meditation, The Doors wouldn't exist.
And I'm sure that's true. You mentioned Jerry Seinfeld as one of the people, and it's an incredible, very, very informative list. I want to get back to the Beatles eventually, but I also want to talk about your first trip after you made a few applications to be able to go to Rishikesh and were finally, after being turned down a few times, finally accepted in 1970. So your first trip over to India was in early 1970, I guess it was January. And again, once again, before you left, you had, a time to kill in New York City before you caught your connecting flight. And you went to the Guggenheim Museum, and you have another interesting encounter with a stranger at the Guggenheim. Can you describe that?
It was very unusual. I met someone who was very friendly and very nice, and he asked if I'd like to walk around the museum with him, which I was most amenable to do, because we were talking about the artists and so on. And so we walked around and just admired the paintings and so forth. And then at the end of our trip, he asked if I would like to have tea with him at the cafe. And so we did have tea together. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, he says to me, this man that you're going to visit in India, this trip you're going to take, to go to this ashram, I warn you not to go. You must cancel this trip because this man is not what he portrays himself to be. He said, you cannot go on this trip. And I was stunned that he just said this out of the blue. It was very strange. And I said, well, no, I have my plane ticket. I'm already prepaid for this course I'm taking, and I'm going on the trip. And then he just got up and left the museum, and I was just sitting there completely shocked and completely stunned. And how did he know about this? And how did he know about Maharishi, who was
because you hadn't mentioned it to him, is that correct?
I hadn't mentioned who I was studying with. I said I was going to India, but I didn't really give him any details. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, he just came up with this and said this to me. And, you know, I figured the man must be out of his mind. He must be insane. So, of course, I took the flight, and I went to India, and I arrived in India and took the course.
And I like your description of seeing the ashram for the first time near Rishikesh. Describe it as, quote, under continual construction.
Yeah, that's very true. Maharishi was like a mad, contractor. He would drive all of his workers crazy by telling to move this brick here and move this cement there. And he was very hands-on, micromanaging the entire construction and telling them to move it there and then move it back there and just, it was really strange. And he was creating all these little streams and rivulets and waterfalls and stuff, but they weren't engineered properly, so the water was not flowing with gravity. It was like a circus over there. It really was.
But you got a lot out of it. More importantly, you stayed with it. And also, as a great example of the relationship you had, I think involves or revolves around the painting that you did. There was some lights that had been strung in trees, and they looked kind of spectacular under a moonlit sky, and that inspired you to draw a painting of it. And why don't you tell us what the Maharishi's reaction was to the first draft of the painting.
Right. So one night, actually we stayed on this course in India, in Rishikesh, India, for 3 months. That's how long the course was. So it was supposed to end on April 7th, and it did end, in fact, on April 7th. But there were some people who stayed behind. There were about 15 of us that stayed behind after the course. And we would meet Maharishi on the roof of his bungalow every night. And we would talk about Vedic literature, in other words, ancient literature of India. And one night, these lights on the trees that Alex just described, they were making like a beautiful scene, actually, of the light touching the trees, and some of the trees looked like they were fully illuminated and some were half illuminated. And so Maharishi was looking at the trees and he made an analogy about these trees and higher states of consciousness. And he was saying that this tree represents what's called cosmic consciousness, this tree represents God consciousness, and this other tree represents unity consciousness. So he described it all, and it was a very nice analogy. And then Jerry Jarvis, who was my meditation teacher, he had taught me transcendental meditation. He was sitting next to me, and all of a sudden he said quite loudly, he said, some artist should make a picture of this. You know, it was like hint, hint, because he knew I was an artist. And so the next day, I actually drew a little sketch of three trees, and I showed it to Maharishi. And he laughed, and he giggled, and he thought it was great, and he kind of cavilled over it, if you happen to know what that word means. In other words, he was profuse about it. And he said something to his second lieutenant, his first lieutenant, whose name was Satyanand, very close friend, let's say. And so they were both looking at the picture. And then Maharishi, all of a sudden, he looks at me and he's laughing and he's complimenting the picture. And then he says, and all the people should be in the picture. And I was like stunned. I was like, oh my God, you're kidding me. You want me to draw all these pictures, all these people? And so he gave it back to me. And I thought, oh my gosh, well, I guess I'll try. So, you know, I tried to draw something, you know, to make it a little bit more detailed. And I showed it to him again, and he said, oh, no, it should be like this. You should change this, and you should change that. And I shouldn't be lying down. I should be sitting up. And, you know, that went on and on, and I kept revising this picture over and over and over. In fact, I revised it for approximately 5 years, and every time I would show it to him, it was never good enough. And this went on for about 5 years. And even the very last time he saw it, okay, so let's say the second to the last time he saw it, he said, he looked at the different picture and he recognized all the people. And then he said, this person, well, you know, he knew the names of every person. He recognized every single person in the picture. But then he said, it should be a better likeness. It should be a better likeness. So every time it was like some improvement had to be made. And in fact, this was always true with Maharishi. Anytime he asked anyone to do anything, he always had them do it over and over and over and over again. And always it had to be much improved every time. So it sort of drove everyone crazy. But we certainly learned from that. We certainly learned patience. We certainly learned how we could be better, how we could improve ourselves. We learned how we should strive for excellence. So, in fact, it was difficult, very difficult for all of us disciples, but we certainly learned along the way. And we became better. We improved. We evolved. We grew. in every way, not only in that skill that we were developing, but also we improved spiritually every time.
That's well put. It's really it's part of the master and disciple relationship, at least as it manifests itself in Eastern cultures. As far as
that's correct, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like, I think it's a good analogy if you just think about military drill instructors. It's similar to that. It's a kind of a tough love where they're trying to train people to become better, and it's pretty harsh in the military. And frankly, it was pretty harsh around Maharishi sometimes, too.
Which you describe in great detail in the book. It would be a mistake to think that it is all love, peace, and happiness. There are plenty of personal travails that you underwent, and I'm looking forward to discussing these as we get into the second hour. We need to take a little tiny break because I have to take care of some station business, but let's do that. But stay on the line, please, Susan Chomsky, and we'll be back in about 60 seconds, all right?
Great.
WMBR in Cambridge, it's Alex McNeil. I'll be here until 2 o'clock this afternoon, and then Angela Grant is in with Coffee Time from 2 until 4. My guest by telephone is Susan Chomsky, who's the author of the new book, Maharishi and Me, Seeking Enlightenment with the Beatles Guru, just out on Skyhorse Publishing, also available electronically. And we're having a conversation really about the whole thing, not only Susan Chomsky's own spiritual journey, both within and without the Maharishi, but also this is the 50th anniversary of the trip to Rishikesh by the Beatles, which took place in the early part of 1968, and that is also a significant part of Susan Chomsky's book. So, you know, I think we'll jump around a little bit, if you don't mind, Susan, and kind of get into some music. One of the fascinating things about the description of the Beatles' time there is how incredibly creative it was for them musically. John Lennon is quoted as saying, I want to get the words correctly as you have them. He says, for creating, it was great. It, meaning the music, was just pouring out. And many, many of the songs that showed up on the so-called White Album, released as a double album at the end of 1968, really had their genesis during their stay in India.
That's very true. In fact, as soon as they met Maharishi in 1967, their music was greatly influenced by him. Very notable, even before they left for Rishikesh, was Across the Universe.
Yes.
Which, in the lyrics of that, it says, Jai Guru Deva Om. And Jai Guru Dev means hail to the divine teacher or the great teacher. And it's a very common expression in India. People say that about their guru, you know, whoever their guru, meaning their spiritual preceptor or spiritual teacher, is called guru in India.
And here it is.
So they said Jai Guru Deva.
Words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. They slither wildly as they slip away across the universe. Pools of sorrow, waves of joy are drifting through my opened mind, possessing and caressing me. Jaguru Deva, oh, nothing's gonna change my world. Nothing's gonna change. Of broken light which dance before me like a million eyes, they call me on and on across the universe. Thoughts meander like a restless wind inside a letterbox. They tumble blindly as they make their way across the universe. Change my world. Nothing's gonna change my world.
words of life are ringing through my open ears, inciting and inviting me. Limitless, undying love which shines around me like a million suns and calls me on and on across the universe. Jaguar.
Across the Universe by the Beatles. That version, by the way, is from Beatles Anthology 2. Several different versions of the song are available. That one's quite a bit different from the one that showed up on the Let It Be album. But it got to say, it's one of my very favorite Beatles songs. It's really a great mood that is set in that song. And as you say, it started actually, and originally, I guess the original tracks were recorded before they left for India, but after they'd learned Transcendental Meditation.
Right, yes. It was released right before they left for India, actually.
But once they got there, as I said earlier, and as you quote in your book, the music just came pouring out. And a couple, I think, are particularly associated with their stay in India and are actually interesting, just if for no other reason than that. I want to talk about Dear Prudence, because one of the other people who was present at the same time, I mean, there were quite, what were there, about 60 people there? It wasn't all celebrities. Am I correct in that?
That's correct. There were about 60 people on the course with the Beatles in India. And, yes, Dear Prudence, who was Mia Farrow's sister, she was one of the attendees. She, like me, had tried to apply to the course over and over and over, and they kept telling her she was too young, just like they kept telling me I was too young. But finally, she got to go simply because her sister was going. And she met with Maharishi in Boston, in Cambridge, actually. She met with Maharishi, and he gave her special permission to go. And so she ended up being on the same course with her sister and with the Beatles.
Although,
and so... Oh, yeah.
Go ahead. Well, as you describe it, though, she was, I guess it's fair to say, she was in a pretty fragile state at the time.
She had taken a lot of drugs and drunk a lot of alcohol for many years. She lived a lifestyle that left a lot to be desired. And as a result, she was mentally unstable. And so she actually had a mental breakdown when she was in India at the course. And it was very serious. She was in bad shape. And during that time, some people asked the Beatles, you know, to sort of check in on her because they were staying in the same complex with her. And Maharishi, in fact, assigned John to just look in on her and make sure she was okay. And so John ended up writing this song, Dear Prudence, because the theme of the song had to do with the fact that she didn't want to leave her room. She wanted to meditate all the time and stay in silence all the time. And so they wrote those words about, won't you come out?
Yeah, won't you come out and play? Yeah.
Yes, yeah, greet the brand new day and so on. So that was written for her. She does not remember them singing it to her when she was there. She remembers them singing Obla Di Obla Da, and she remembers them singing some other lyrics, some other songs, but never Dear Prudence.
Interesting.
And in fact, she didn't even realize that they had written a song about her until John was leaving. On his way out of the ashram, he said, hey, John wrote this song about you. George Harrison told her that.
And here it is. Dear Prudence by the Beatles from the White Album. By the way, in case you're listening extra carefully, that was a mono mix of that. We happen to have the Beatles mono albums here on the CD in our record library, and I thought you might enjoy hearing the mono mixes because in some cases they're a little bit different and the instruments come out a little bit differently. So Dear Prudence by the Beatles, inspired by Prudence Farrell, who was with them in Rishikesh with the Maharishi. Again, I'm talking to Susan Chomsky, author of the new book, Maharishi and Me, Seeking Enlightenment with the Beatles Guru, which is just out by Skyhorse Publishing. So there are, as we said, there's so many songs we could talk about because practically the entire White Album had some kind of connection to their stay in Rishikesh. But we've got a lot of other things we want to talk about and some other artists we also want to talk about as well. So before we leave Rishikesh temporarily, because I do want to get into your own journey in the 70s and on into the 80s as well, we should mention that Donovan was also there, and he too was inspired.
Yes, he was very greatly inspired by Maharishi. In fact, he, even before he went to Rishikesh, he released this box set album that had Maharishi's picture on the back cover of it. So he was a great devotee of Maharishi and of transcendental meditation, and he continues to be till this day, in fact.
And he wrote the song Hurdy Gurdy Man is
right
specifically about Maharishi, correct?
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah.
And here it is. I think this is some studio chatter to begin with. We've got it on a box set here, but here we go.
Thrown like a star by vast if I open my eyes to take a peek, to find that I was by the sea, gazing with tranquility. Then when the hurdy-gurdy man came singing songs of love, then when the hurdy-gurdy man came singing songs of love. Histories of ages past, unenlightened shadows cast down through all eternity, the crying of humanity. Tis then when the hurdy-gurdy man comes singing songs of love. Then when the hurdy-gurdy man comes singing songs of love.
Gurdy Man by Donovan, who was inspired to write that song. That's about Maharishi, correct?
It certainly yes. is. Mm-hmm. And he also wrote a song about transcendental meditation. It was called Happiness Runs.
And yes, I've got that here. Should we listen to that, or should we move on? It's your call.
My call?
Yeah.
Well, I'm enjoying hearing the songs. It's really fun, actually. Yeah, I'd love to hear Happiness Run.
Now you're lying here in my hand. How many years have you been here? Little human upon the sand, from where I'm lying here in your hand, you to me are but a passing breeze. The sun will always shine where you stand, depending in which land you may find yourself. Now you have my blessing, go your way. Happiness runs in a circular motion. Thought is like a little boat upon the sea. Everybody is a part of everything anyway. You can have everything if you let yourself be. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs in a circular motion. Thought is like a little boat upon the sea. Everybody is a part of everything anyway. You can have everything if you let yourself see. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs in a circular motion. Thought is like a little boat upon the sea. Everybody is a part of everything anyway. You can have everything if you let yourself see. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Why because? Why because? Why because? Why because? Happiness runs in a circular motion. Thought is like a little boat upon the sea. Everybody is a part of everything anyway. You can have everything if you let yourself be. You can have everything if you let yourself be. You can have everything if you let yourself be. You can have everything if you let yourself be. You can have everything if you let yourself be. You can have everything if you let yourself be. You can have everything if you let yourself be. You can have everything if you let yourself be. You can have everything if you let yourself be. You can have everything if you let yourself be. You can have everything if you let yourself be. You can have everything if you let yourself be.
Happiness Runs by Donovan. It's really a round, I guess, isn't it? But very nicely done.
Yeah.
Again, inspired by his transcendental meditation.
Absolutely.
I do want to, again, we'll get back to Rishikesh, but I also want to talk about your own journey, because it's certainly the major part of the book is your own spiritual journey over several decades. And the 70s, it was a peripatetic time for you. I guess that's the right adjective, isn't it? Because you're in Italy, Spain, United States, all over the place with Maharishi. And then he orders you in 1976 to, quote, go to the States and make a lot of money. You're too much dependent upon me as a person. I won't always be here.
Yes, right. I spent 6 years with him on his international staff, where we were traveling around Europe. As you said, we were also in Switzerland and Austria and other countries. And it was quite a whirlwind. It was very intense emotionally. There were extremes, emotional extremes all the time. Heaven, hell, heaven, hell. It was quite an experience to be on his staff and to be that close with him for so many years. And then eventually, you know, I was very, very dependent on him. So eventually he told me to go back to the States. And it was very devastating for me to be told to leave. I definitely did not want to leave. I wanted to stay with him, quote unquote, forever, which is obviously very unrealistic. But he did tell me to go back to the States. And so I did. And it was a huge adjustment for me. It was very challenging for me to now make my way in the big wide world when I'd been under this kind of bubble of protection of the ashram for so long.
And you landed yourself right in New York City, so it couldn't be more of a jolt.
I did. It was quite a jolt. That's a good way to describe it, Alex. So there I was, and I had to try to make a living, and it was extremely challenging. But Maharishi had always called me Susan the Artist. I was an artist. I went to art school and so on. So I ended up actually designing jewelry. I ended up as a freelance jewelry designer, which I did for the next 20 years. And I designed diamond jewelry for jewelry manufacturers in New York City. Also, though, I ended up staying in the TM facility, which was up in Westchester County, New York. It was in what's called Armonk, New York, which is near Mount Kisco.
Mm-hmm.
And I was staying there It was a transcendental meditation retreat center. And so I was living there, in fact. And strangely, so was Howard Stern. As he was doing his radio show in Briarcliff near there, he was staying there, too.
One of the last people you might expect to find in a TM center, right?
Yes, but he has actually practiced TM mm-hmm. for 40 years, and he's a huge advocate of it.
Well, and very interesting, as you say, there's a huge number of people that you mention in your appendix to your book, Maharishi and Me, who have and still do practice transcendental meditation. One of the points you make that I thought was very interesting is, yes, he's a spiritual master and a guru, but at the same time, he is also a human being. And he also never holds himself out as anything other than a human being. Sometimes he says, I'm just a meditation teacher. And you make an interesting point that, you know, all people, they get tired, they get hungry, they get frustrated. And the same is true of people even at higher states of consciousness, as long as they're mortal. And that's certainly a critical element of your book, and I certainly appreciated reading your take on that.
Yes, it's very true. People have this very unrealistic idea about what a spiritual master is, how a spiritual master acts. And also people have a very unrealistic idea about what it means to be quote-unquote enlightened. So they think that a enlightened quote-unquote human being is going to act in a certain way that's completely different than other people. And in fact, that's not necessarily true. Just because they're in a higher state of consciousness does not make them act in a way that people expect. And people have a lot of expectations about behavior of quote unquote enlightened people. And, you know, they go to the bathroom, they fart, they're just like regular human beings as well as having an elevated state of consciousness.
And the set of expectations, I suppose that's a nice segue to talk about the departure of the Beatles from Rishikesh, although they actually departed in sort of three waves. Ringo, I think, was the last to arrive and the first to go. He and his wife only stayed about 10 days. He claimed that it was the spicy food, although, as you point out, the food was anything but spicy at at the ashram. So, it was not really his cup of tea, although he had good things to say about it. So, but his stay was the shortest. Paul McCartney left, I think, after maybe 4 or 5 weeks, with good things to say then and now about it. And meanwhile, George Harrison and John Lennon stayed the longest, and things sort of came to a head in April. And one of the points you make in your book, Maharishi and Me, is the true story of what prompted George and John to leave. There are a lot of different stories. One is that they thought that Maharishi was making passes at some of the women who were there. There's also the complicating factor of two film crews coming in to make a documentary about this, and I guess George and John felt that they were possibly being exploited about that, as well as the third story that you detail in your book. So clear it up for us, Susan Chomsky.
Yes, as you said, there's three reasons why the Beatles left India, and one had to do with this film deal, where Maharishi had promised exclusive rights to film him and to make a movie about transcendental meditation and about Maharishi's guru, whom he called Gurudev. And so they were going to make this film. And in fact, Neil Aspinall came and Dennis O'Dell came to negotiate the contract with
Maharishi. Neil Aspinall, we should say, high up in the Beatles, Apple Corps. So connected with the Beatles from day one, really, yes. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, I'm glad you did interrupt me, because people are going to wonder, who are these people she's talking about? Yeah, so these Apple Corps people came to meet with Maharishi. They negotiated a contract with him. Neil went back to London. And then not too long after that, the Beatles told him to come back with a film crew and film the proceedings there in Rishikesh. But unfortunately, Maharishi had made the same promise to someone else. His lieutenant in the United States, Charlie Lutz, who was the head of the spiritual regeneration movement in the United States, Maharishi told him to go ahead and sign a contract with Four Star Productions in Hollywood. And he did that. And in fact, he arrived in Rishikesh with a signed contract that gave Four Star Production exclusive rights to film Maharishi for the next 5 years. So they arrived, the lawyer arrived in Rishikesh, and then the film crew arrived, the Four Star Production film crew. They arrived before the Apple Corps film crew. So they arrived in Rishikesh. And one morning, John Lennon opened the door to his bungalow, and there he was on the threshold of the door. He was bedheaded. He was bleary-eyed. And he's just, you know, sort of looking groggy, looking outside his door. And there's standing there is a cameraman and a director yelling, "Action!" And there's John Lennon is now expected to be a two-bit player in the film that he didn't know anything about. So he rebelled immediately. He and George refused to leave their bungalow. They refused to go to the lecture hall where the lights and cameras were set up. And so that was really a big break with Maharishi, because they were very disillusioned by this. You know, why did he do this to us? You know, we thought we had exclusive rights to make a film, and then there's this other film. And then they realize, well, maybe he's been exploiting us for publicity all along, because in fact he had come out with a record album in 1967, and on the cover of the record album it said that this was the Beatles guru, and also Maharishi kept promising ABC that he would do a special with the Beatles. And the Beatles kept saying, no, we're not going to do that. And Maharishi kept telling ABC that he was going to do it over and over and over. He kept telling ABC, and the Beatles kept telling him to stop saying that. And in fact, Paul and George went to Sweden with Peter Brown. They flew to Sweden to see Maharishi, where he happened to be at the time. They flew there just to tell him to stop telling ABC this. So those are some of the things that happened between the Beatles and Maharishi that made them realize, you know, he's exploiting us for publicity. Well, you know, I don't know that I necessarily agree with that, but yeah, he definitely was using the Beatles, who were also using him. I mean, the fact was there was a mutual relationship, and the Beatles were very keen on transcendental meditation, and so they were really promoting it a lot. And because of that, Maharishi became very popular and became very famous at the time. And in fact, even after the Beatles walked out of Rishikesh in a huff, even after that, Maharishi became hugely, hugely popular. There were people waiting to learn transcendental meditation. There were lines lined up around the blocks in all the major cities to learn TM. So, you know, that was one reason why the Beatles left Rishikesh. And then there were the other two reasons, which I can get into if you want me to get into those right now.
Well, sure. And then, you know, I thought while you were talking, there's also a fourth reason. If not too many people may be familiar with Magic Alex Martis, who was a kind of a hanger-on in the Beatles circles, particularly he had John's ear quite a bit. And he had something to do with kind of wanting to sever their association. He wanted to get John back in his own camp, I guess is perhaps the bluntest way to put it. But so there, all these currents are going on at the same time. So it must have been, to say the least, an ugly situation that it had devolved into after really several weeks of a great creative period.
Absolutely. Magic Alex, who is also called Alexis Martis, was his real name. And he sort of attached himself to John Lennon's hip. And Cynthia, she said, quote unquote, Alexis made my skin crawl.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she really didn't like him at all. And she thought that he was having this kind of Svengali influence over John, which upset her very much. And he came to Rishikesh with the express purpose of getting the Beatles away from Maharishi. He said it blatantly. And he was never seen meditating, quite the opposite, never meditated while he was there. Even though he did learn transcendental meditation, in fact, he went to the Hilton Hotel on August 25th of 1967, along with the Beatles. He was one of the people that was right there. And in fact, he encouraged the Beatles to learn TM. He was part of that, the people who were trying to get them to practice TM. So he came to India, started having an affair with a woman named Rosalind, and they were starting rumors around the ashram that Maharishi had made a pass at her. And she claims till this day that definitely Maharishi did make a pass at her. And they spread the rumor throughout the ashram, and Alexis claimed that he had hid outside Maharishi's house and had seen Maharishi hugging Rosalind. They were both clothed, fully clothed. And that's all he saw. And he told the Beatles they had seen that. And Rosalind claimed that Maharishi had made a pass at her. And then they debated it all night long one night, you know, after the Beatles found out about it. And George didn't believe it. He didn't believe Alexis. He didn't trust Alexis. But finally, Alexis kind of persuaded George that it has to be true. It was true. I saw it. And, you know, he had his own agenda. Because the reason why he wanted to get the Beatles away from Maharishi is because John Lennon had introduced Alexis to the other Beatles as, quote unquote, my guru, Magic Alex. So because he was supposedly the Beatles guru, he didn't like them to have this other guru.
Although Magic Alex turned out to be anything but magic. He had all these, I guess it's fair to say, ridiculous ideas for technology. He was going to build them a new studio at Apple that was going to be, revolutionary, and he didn't know the first thing about constructing a recording studio, and he was never able to solve the most basic problem of electronic hum, and all kinds of other cockamamie comes to mind. Just ideas that pretty far out, and I don't think any of them ever came to fruition. So, and he's gone.
No.
Magic Alex is gone now too. So we can it's fair to speak of him. But anyway, all these currents happening at the same time, and of course, that friction with Maharishi, especially between John and Maharishi, inspired the song "Sexy Sadie."
Exactly.
Which I think he was going to be even more blunt about it, but I think George persuaded him to at least change the title word over to Sadie so it wouldn't be quite as obvious.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
Before we leave, and I know we've got about 20 minutes. I'm sorry, you were going to say that there's also the fourth thread that I think you give the most credence to, which is the fact that drugs are present at the ashram.
Well, it didn't come out until 2006 when Deepak Chopra was very, very close to Maharishi. And it was actually 1991 that George Harrison requested of Deepak that he meet Maharishi in Holland. Maharishi was living in a Vlodrop in the Netherlands. And Deepak set up a meeting between George Harrison and Maharishi. So this is what transpired during the meeting, according to Deepak. They sat down, and George Harrison gave Maharishi some flowers. And then there was silence for quite a long time. And then George said to Maharishi, "I came to apologize, Maharishi." And Maharishi said, "For what?" And George said, "You know what for." And Maharishi said to George, "Tell Deepak the story." So George, in the presence of Maharishi, proceeded to tell Deepak that when they were in India, that they had been drinking alcohol and taking drugs at the ashram. And when I say they, it means some members of their party, not necessarily everybody, but some people. And that includes John Lennon, by the way, it includes Alexis, that they were taking some drugs. I don't know what drugs specifically, but John was definitely taking hashish. And they were also drinking alcohol. Alexis was smuggling in bottles of alcohol into the ashram. And some of the women, and he and Rosalyn, definitely, and I don't know about the other Beatles, they were drinking alcohol. So that's definitely against the rules of the ashram. You're not allowed to do any of that there. And because of that, Maharishi asked them to leave. So that was the story that George told Deepak in front of Maharishi, and Deepak reported that in the Times of India. So that was the fourth reason why the Beatles left India, because Maharishi asked them to leave.
Yeah, he asked them to leave, but on the other hand, he didn't want to embarrass them, so he didn't make it public at the time, his reason. Well, you know, given the fact that you just recounted the story of George Harrison meeting up in 1989 with Maharishi to apologize, the next song I wanted to play is, this will be the final one from the White Album, because I do want to talk about some other things with you before we have to finish up the show. One of my favorite songs from the White Album is a George Harrison song. Not everybody likes it, but I sure do, called Long, Long, Long. And I think it's fair to say George certainly, before 67 and afterward, was the most spiritual of the four. Very interested in Indian culture and religion from about 1965, when somebody handed him a sitar while they were filming Help. And he stayed with it for the remainder of his life. So is there anything in particular you'd like to say about the song Long, Long, Long?
Yes, it's another song that's about transcendental meditation. And it's about the search for spiritual enlightenment. So that's what it is.
Long, 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 a George Harrison composition from the Beatles' White Album, officially known as The Beatles, released at the end of 1968, and inspired by their stay in Rishikesh with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. Again, my guest this afternoon has been Susan Shumsky, author of the new book, Maharishi and Me, Seeking Enlightenment with a Beatles Guru. I want to get back actually to your journey, however. We've kind of hopscotched around musical selections this afternoon, but you spent 2 years designing jewelry and then went back, joined the Maharishi staff again, and spent most of the 80s, if I remember correctly, in Fairfield, Iowa, on the campus of Maharishi International University.
Yes, yes. I was designing jewelry for 20 years, actually. And even when I was in Fairfield, Iowa, I continued to design jewelry. And I was part of that community there, off and on, for 10 years. I mean, when I say off and on, sometimes I was in other TM communities, like there was one in Washington, D.C. I was there for a while. I was also in India for a while with Maharishi again in early 80s. So, yeah, I was living in different places, but always involved with the Transcendental Meditation Organization, always living in their facilities, actually, different facilities, yeah.
The sense I get, though, from the latter chapters of your book, though, is that well, how should I put it? That the administration by some of the lieutenants, shall we say, becomes a little bit more, well, cult-like is the one that comes to mind. They're trying to control really other aspects of your life as far as what books you read and what other diversions you partake of and things like that. And it begins to get a little troublesome, and if I may say so.
It was very disturbing for me. I just thought that it was getting so controlling. Maharishi didn't used to be like that in the beginning. The organization was certainly not like that in the beginning. It was all about just practicing TM for a few minutes, morning and afternoon, and the rest of your life was supposed to be your own, and you were supposed to be able to do anything you wanted. But then later in the 80s, it just became so controlling. And I think the last straw was when I went into the library at Maharishi International University in Fairfield, Iowa. And in the library there, they had removed all books that were not officially sanctioned by the TM organization. They removed any and all New Age books. They removed any spiritual books that were not written by Maharishi. In other words, books by Yogananda, by Vivekananda, by Muktananda and other Anandas, other spiritual teachers. They removed all those books. They banned all those books. And that, to me, I mean, that was just sort of the last straw. That was very upsetting to me when I saw that there was this kind of censorship going on. It just seemed crazy. And everything got really controlling. Your life had to be entirely 24/7, quote unquote, on the program, and anything that diverted from the TM party line, shall we say, that was just not allowed. And, you know, I'm more of a free spirit, let's put it
well,
that way.
And that became really a problem for you, because starting in 1986, you began to learn another technique called divine revelation. And
right.
It's interesting, you write in the book, years of meditation and silence prepared me for this teaching. And you make a point of
right.
saying you didn't give up transcendental meditation, but that caused a problem for the higher-ups at MIU, correct?
It definitely did. And, you know, I got blacklisted, basically. There was blacklisting going on during that period of time. In fact, one of the first people who got blacklisted was John Gray, who wrote the book Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. He and his wife at the time, who was Barbara DeAngelis, they were teaching classes in relationships. And they got blacklisted for teaching those classes, which had nothing to do with meditation. I was completely shocked that they got blacklisted. And when I say blacklisted, it means that you weren't allowed to go on any TM courses. You weren't allowed to practice the meditation in the TM centers or in Fairfield, Iowa, in the what they called the Golden Domes, which were these huge geodesic domes, really gigantic domes where people practiced meditation together. So, you know, they were banned from all of that. And they weren't the only ones who got blacklisted, but they're very well-known people who did. And I was blacklisted also.
What is this? What is the status? I know Maharishi passed away. Was it about 10 years ago? Is that right?
It was, yeah. It was 10 years ago in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what is the status of the movement now? Does the university still exist on the Iowa campus?
In fact, it does. Mm-hmm. And the name has been changed to Maharishi University of Management. And it's still going. In fact, I visited there not too long ago, and, you know, the students were there, and it's still going, yeah,
oh, so
in Fairfield, Iowa.
You were not a persona non grata this time, so you were able to return. That's good to hear. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I'm still a persona non grata, definitely. But I'm missing to promote my book and to tell people about it. And people were very open to it. You know, a lot of people showed up for my book signings, and it was great. I had a great time visiting there. It was wonderful.
Well, let's hope that the movement certainly continues to gain some strength. I think the square root of 1%? Do I have the formula right? Maharishi thought,
yeah,
that if we could get the square root of 1% to be serious meditators, we could help solve a lot of problems that the world faces.
Absolutely. In fact, he did scientific studies on it, and there were statistical studies that proved that when people meditate in groups together, that it does reduce crime, it does reduce war. I mean, I know that sounds like a crazy statement, but in fact, he did statistical studies that were definitely proved his contention that people meditating together can create a more peaceful world.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and
great.
Even if one downplays the spiritual aspect, as I think what was the book about 20 years ago, The Relaxation Response, just the chance to sit down, try to free your mind, you know, slow your heartbeat down, slow your pulse down, and slow your breathing rate down, is amazing for one's own personal health, you know, if nothing
Absolutely.
Else. You know, at the very, very biological, shall we say, or corporeal core of it. It's just some things that are inwardly good for you, regardless of any spiritual aspect you put on top of that.
Exactly. Meditation has been proven through hundreds and hundreds of scientific studies. Not only this form of meditation, but other forms of meditation have been studied. And it's been proven over and over again that meditation is great for health, it's great for well-being, it's great not only physically, but also mentally, psychologically, emotionally. It's just good for people, and it's going to be beneficial. So I definitely advocate meditation. I think people should practice it, and it will reduce stress, and it just makes people happier. I was never really happy until I learned meditation. After I learned meditation, I experienced happiness for the first time, real happiness.
That's great. That's great to hear. Again, my guest this afternoon, who's been very generous with her time for the last 80-some minutes, has been Susan Shumsky, author of the new book, Maharishi and Me, Seeking Enlightenment with the Beatles Guru, published by Skyhorse Publishing this year. And best of luck with the book, and it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for spending time with us this afternoon. It's been great, and also it's given us a chance to listen to some of the songs that had their genesis back in the Beatles' stay at Rishikesh back in 1968 that you also discuss in your book. So thank you once again, Susan Shumsky.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Alex. I really, really enjoyed our time together, and I loved listening to the music. It was so wonderful.
Well, I tell you, I was listening on headphones to the mono mix of the stuff we heard from the White Album, and it really, really sounds good. I guess you have to hear it over a phone line, so that's a little bit of a deterioration. But anyway, thanks for sharing not only the story of your own spiritual journey, but also discussing in detail the Beatles' stay at Rishikesh. Again, my guest has been Susan Shumsky. So long. And let's finish up with one more from the White Album. Here's Mother Nature's Son.
Can you take this thing off my voice? I've got, like, the speaker I can hear. Thank you. Okay, leave it on then. Good.
Born a boy, young country boy, Mother Nature. listen. All day long I'm sitting singing songs for everyone. Sit beside a mountain stream, see a waters rise. Listen to the pretty sound of music as she flies.
That does it for the Friday Lost and Found. We close things out with a version of Mother Nature's Son from the Beatles Anthology 3. Again, I want to thank my guest, Susan Chomsky, author of Maharishi and Me, for her generosity with her time this afternoon, talking about her new book. Coming up on Lost and Found Monday, let's see, Mark Francis. Tuesday, Rick Biscuit Roth is here. Wednesday, Brother Wayne. Thursday, Christopher Weiss. He's got a guest DJ who pledged for airtime. I think it's Mark Weiss is his name. And I'll be back a week from today, kicking off Memorial Day weekend, as we will finish up the In Memoriam segment of Lost and Found here. Stay tuned for Coffee Time with Angela and Grant, right here on WMBR in Cambridge, first on your FM dial.